All right, what is up, good citizens of Crypt Nation? We got a big announcement today. We're giving away some free stuff. Who likes free stuff? I know I do. I know Pizza Mind is a big freeloader. Just kidding. And he's not even here to defend himself. Today, we have a special guest. He's the CEO and founder of a company called CoinMine. And these are plug-and-play crypto miners for Bitcoin, Ethereum, all sorts of different cryptos. And we're going to shell one of these puppies out. So in order to be eligible for the giveaway, there's three easy peasy requirements. Number one, you got to go to www.crypto2020summit.com and register for the free online conference that we're hosting January 29th to 31st are the dates. So go do that right now. Pause the episode. First things first, get registered for that. Second thing, you got to make sure that you're following us on Twitter. That is at Crypto101Pod. And if you don't have a Twitter, well, you better go make a Twitter because you won't be eligible to win without a Twitter. And the third thing is you got to retweet our pinned post, which is at the top of our page. So if you do those three things, you are entered for the chance to win your very own, super easy to use, CoinMine One. And you can finally call yourself a real deal crypto miner. And that's something to be proud of. The official winner will be announced on the pod on December 2nd on that Monday's episode, and you will have directions on how to claim your prize. So, Crypt Nation, if you've done those three things, it's time to kick back, relax, and enjoy this awesome episode on crypto mining with Farboud Nivi, the CEO and founder of CoinMine. Farboud, thank you for joining us today, my man.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So stoked to jump into the 101 on crypto mining. I mean, this is, it really, really is the end all be all of cryptocurrency. Without miners, none of us would have existed in the first place. They're the ones that bootstrap the network. They're the ones that, you know, protect us, right? So what is a crypto miner? What is cryptocurrency mining? Give us the 101.
Sure. So, you know, at CoinMine, we try to keep things super simple. Mining is a type of computation. You know, there's lots of types of computation that a processor could do. And in crypto, there's multiple types of computation that actually go on. Mining is one of them, and it's, you know, sort of the one of the first types of computation that was involved in crypto. So crypto mining is, you know, the process of, you know, generating new blocks on the blockchain of some crypto protocol. And if you are the one to sort of find the next block first, you're rewarded with some cryptocurrency. So in a really basic relationship, you plug in a computer into your electricity. Your electricity turns into computation, and your computation helps secure this network. And in exchange for helping secure the network, you're rewarded with that network's cryptocurrency. So today, most people who are, you know, participating in mining are doing it in a pool, for example, running just like one single Bitcoin ASIC miner at home. You'll probably never find a block, and you'll, you know, it might take 10 million years for you to find a block. So what you do instead is you'll join a pool. And when you get a bunch of these little things pooled together and you put their computation together, the pool can actually win blocks. And then what it does is sort of split up that Bitcoin or different, you know, crypto that it earns with the different people who shared their computation. So even if you're not, you know, winning the block yourself, you can still contribute to securing a network and receive that network's crypto for your computation. I don't know if that's what you were asking.
No, but that's perfect. So you would say probably the average way that a consumer like me and Pizza Mind or anybody part of Crypt Nation here, they would get involved by being part of a pool. And so does CoinMine, if I'm running a CoinMine miner, is that contributing to the CoinMine pool, or what does that look like?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, and this can change based on what protocol that you're running. Part of the reason we designed the CoinMine the way we did is to make it a more generalized crypto device. You know, people are obviously focused on the mining. It's one of the first things it does, you know, and it was the first thing it did out the gate, mining a few different proof of work networks. But, you know, soon we'll be launching additional networks, most of them proof of work for now. The device ships with the full Bitcoin blockchain, so we'll turn on the Bitcoin node and the Lightning node later this year, probably. We plan on making it a full BTC pay server, so you can basically be your own bank with your CoinMine. There's more and more things that are, you know, we're talking to a few other protocols that do things that, you know, you could imagine a CoinMine with a Gotenna in it that allows it to have some wider range. Now you can build a sort of a sovereign mesh network of information and money transfer. So there's a lot of things you can do with the device. And first and foremost, it mines crypto with a pool.
That is really fascinating.
Thank you.
Usually crypto mining is a very hard thing to get into, but the CoinMine one, I mean, it's literally so simple. It takes 10 minutes. The instruction steps are 3 steps long. Right. You don't have to plug it into a monitor. It's controlled by your phone. Yeah. Would you say that crypto mining is for everyone? Or is it really still just kind of a select few that are going to be involved in it?
You know, that's a good question. You know, I think crypto is for everyone. I look at this as a large platform ship for the internet. Now, does everyone in the world have a smartphone? No. But is the smartphone for everyone? Yes. You know, does everyone in the world have a coin mine yet? No. But is it for everyone? Yeah, it's made for everyone. So, you know, obviously it depends on each person's own desire to participate in the future or not. You know, there are cultures like the Amish people who, you know.
Well, I think that brings up a really good point, because remember back in the day when SegWit 2x was coming around and we had this whole user activated soft fork event, that was 2017. And the only way that, you know, the users kind of vetoed the miners was because they were running full nodes and they could have a voice. So it's actually super, super, super important that people are running full nodes. So this is kind of a two-part question in context of that event, since it was so historic and it's pretty recent and fresh in our memories. Can you talk about the difference between a full node and a mining node and why, you know, running a full node is important and why, you know, part of CoinMine's mission is to get full nodes in the hands of every Bitcoin user?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so if you look at the distribution of mining versus validating nodes, and I'm assuming you're kind of referencing the validating nodes when you sort of talk about the full nodes as opposed to the non-mining ones. The distribution is kind of interesting. The bulk of the mining hash power is centered in Asia, mainly China. The bulk of the validating computation power, right? Because validating is another type of computation in crypto. Mining is a type of computation. Validating is a type of computation. On Lightning Network, routing is a type of computation, and watchtowering will be a type of computation. In staking is a type of computation. So yeah, crypto, right? In terms of validating nodes, and so the validating nodes are actually concentrated more in Europe and North America. So there's this interesting global aspect to Bitcoin, but there is also a little bit of, you know, bucketing. So we see a lot of mining going on in Asia, and particularly in China. We see a bulk of the validating nodes happening elsewhere. You're not really earning anything in terms of crypto for running just the node. You're not being given Bitcoin for it, whereas the miners are. So, you know, Bitcoin is one of the things I like that Nassim Taleb says. Is he kind of describes it as a genie that got out of the bottle. Once it's out, it can never be put back in. And the other sort of big aspect of crypto is a lot of game theory, right? And how these different aspects of this network pull on each other and maintain this tension such that, you know, no party controls it entirely, and no party is particularly incented to destroy it. You know, even for us, that whole, you know, Bitcoin block size war is really relevant. So one of my friends and sort of people I really look up to in crypto, Balaji Srinivasan, who was recently CTO of Coinbase. He was also one of our first checks. I think he's one of the, you know, the brightest minds in the space, if not just one of the brightest minds in general. And, you know, when they were doing 21.com, which was sort of the, you know, one of the predecessors to CoinMine in a way, they pivoted away from 21.com. And it's amazing how fast the crypto world works, because this was just a few years ago, right? They pivoted away from 21 into earn.com, because this was actually sort of during the time of the block size wars. And there was two things that kind of caused them to do this. One, they didn't want to be in the middle of the block size wars. But two, and this is actually the more amazing one, I think, when you think about it now, they weren't convinced that a multi-coin world was here to stay. And of course they are now. Of course he is now. And I am as well. And so if they were convinced that a multi-coin world was here to stay, they probably would have never shut down 21.com. So I don't know if that answered your question or went.
Yeah, no, that was perfect. And, you know, that's super relevant. And I kind of also we definitely want to touch on the game theory behind crypto mining, because that's like the most interesting thing, in my opinion, out of everything in cryptocurrency. But before we get there, I kind of want to talk about the evolution of mining. So back in the day, people would be able to run their MacBook on their CPU and mine 50 Bitcoin, and it was like nothing. And then as more miners came on the network, you know, the difficulty adjusts, and what, every 2 weeks or something, right? Difficulty adjusts based on how many miners are there. So paint a picture for the audience of what crypto mining was like back in the day, and how with the evolution of ASICs, and how it's a trillion, or not trillion, it's like, you know, billions and billions of dollar industry. Like, you've been in it since the beginning. What's the differences between 2011 mining and 2019 mining?
Yeah, there's differences and there's similarities. So, you know, in 2010, 2011, you can mine Bitcoin on your laptop, which is really cool. You were still called a crazy person by your friends. You were told that you were wasting a perfectly good laptop. Let's not, you know, nobody in 2010 and 2011 was thinking about $10,000 Bitcoin and $15,000 Bitcoin. So generally, you were probably considered a nut who was wasting their electricity, because it wasn't ROI positive on your electricity.
Right, because the Bitcoin had no value. So they were mining these things that, you know, okay, cool, I have 50 things, but whatever, just toss them.
Yeah, you'll spend 10,000 of them on a pizza. So you were wasting money. You were basically, you know, running a computer into the ground that was a perfectly useful computer. So I don't know why you're wasting this and destroying this computer by just running it at its full speed constantly. But it turns out you, if you held on to that Bitcoin for a few more years, and in fact, if you've held on to Bitcoin for any 3-year period in its entire history, you always made money on the Bitcoin. So take any 3-year
period. That's a great statistic.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? And that's why I think it's important to think about, you know, and a lot of people talk about this, you know, having a low time preference when it comes to Bitcoin or when it comes to crypto in general. But if you held your Bitcoin for any 3-year period, you always made money. So if you did that back in the day, then you probably did pretty well. And you were no longer a crazy who was wasting their money. So I actually think in many ways there's similarities between that and today. So Grin is an example that I use. Grin launched earlier this year. I think of Grin as the closest thing to Bitcoin since Bitcoin. Yeah. And Grin launched earlier this year. And on a device like the CoinMine, for example, I think it's currently pulling about almost a Grin every 7 to 10 days. So I think it's a similar situation. If you're bullish on Grin, right now I think it's probably trading at anywhere between $1 to $3. At one point it was up to $6. If you think it gets to $30, $100, $300, and you have that, you know, 1 to 3 year time preference, and you use your CoinMine to keep mining Grin, you'll make thousands or tens of thousands of dollars on your CoinMine.
Wowza. You hear that, Crypt Nation? You should sign up for the giveaway, because this could potentially be life-changing amounts of money.
It could be, potentially, is a good way to put it. And just like in 2010 and 2011, you could say that mining Bitcoin on your laptop could be potentially a life-changing thing. So, you know, Bitcoin... All things have their life cycle. Bitcoin has it. All cryptos do. All technologies do. All living beings and planets and galaxies do as well. So In Bitcoin's life cycle, it was the earliest, and it's, you know, so far sort of grown to be the most powerful, most secure database in the world by far. And part of how that happened was that people figured out how to make chips that were just sort of specific to that calculation that Bitcoin is doing. So on a, you know, there's a lot of, you know, people speak mostly colloquially around these terms like ASICs and FPGAs and CPUs and GPUs. There's a lot more sort of overlap when you talk about it from an industry perspective than when we talk about it from, you know, just the crypto world. So you can look at it this way, sort of in a general case. If you have CPUs over here, they're sort of like the most generalized compute. Then you have GPUs that are a little bit more specific in the type of compute they do. So they do that type of computing, specifically graphics processing, better in terms of how much electricity has to be spent to accomplish the computation than a CPU does. Then you move over to FPGA, which stands for Field Programmable Gate Array. Now, an FPGA is something that was developed by the U.S. military. It's essentially a blank slate processor. So with a firmware upgrade and a restart of the processor, you can turn an FPGA into any sort of like specific type of processor that is designed for a specific type of computation. And then on the extreme end, you have ASICs, which are application specific, right? So they do one single type of computation, but they are the most efficient at that. They're more efficient at that computation than an FPGA probably will be, more than a GPU, and more than a CPU. But they have no generalizability.
So in Bitcoin's case, you have ASICs that are mostly built by Bitmain, I suppose, and maybe a couple other guys.
Others, yeah.
And they're doing only SHA-256 hashes. Is that right?
SHA-256, another thing developed by the U.S. Well, not military, the NSA.
Whoa. Did not know that.
Yeah. All the SHA algorithms were developed by the NSA and made public.
As you mentioned earlier, you said something about running hardware into the ground. And that is the biggest risk, in my opinion, of mining, is you really burn out this stuff. And a lot of it has to do with you're trying to get the maximum amount of efficiency out of your hardware. At least that's the game theory behind a lot of mining rigs that are built, is really just pushing these things. GPUs were really cheap. I mean, they would just burn through them in like 6 months. And that happens due to the surge in electricity, due to the heat, and basically forcing this hardware to do something it was not designed to do. When you guys designed the coin mine, I know you had this in mind. What is the risks of mining with a coin mine versus a traditional rig? What is, you know, the expected lifespan of a coin mine? Are there spare parts or replacements available?
Yeah, good question. When you say traditional rig, just to make sure I'm understanding what you mean.
Like a 6 GPU open air rig.
Okay. So, you know, the coin mine is warranted for a year. If anything goes wrong with it in the year, we'll replace it or fix it for you. It is obviously designed to try and increase its life, to keep its lifespan as long as possible. So trying to push less electricity through it to do more computation, for example. Also, the thermodynamics of the casing and everything are designed to keep it as cool as possible while keeping it as quiet as possible.
I guess, what are the risks that people need to be aware of before they get involved in crypto mining?
I mean, there's a lot of risks. I think the simplest way to put it is, you know, I think we're still in a world where you should not invest money in buying crypto, or, you know, crypto mining, or running a Lightning node, or anything really in crypto. I don't personally recommend, you know, this is not financial advice, but I don't think you should spend money you can't afford to lose.
Yeah, that's a great word. That's what we definitely tell all of our crusaders of Crypt Nation here, to not go overboard. You know what I'm saying?
Put yourself into financial risk. It's still very early. And that's the safest way to participate in the most parts of things possible, and sort of learn and grow as crypto grows to become the, you know, the next platform for the world. So, you know, if you, you know, you shouldn't spend your last dollars on anything in crypto, in my humble opinion.
Or anything outside of crypto for that matter. I know the iPhone 11 is just coming out and people are taking pre-orders, but do you really need a new iPhone? Yeah. Or would you rather secure a Bitcoin network, which is changing the world, and make some potentially life-changing money over time?
Yeah, I think I think it's interesting. People are always talk about, you know, invest in this or invest in that. You know, it's obviously tough to make investment decisions. You can't actually compare pairwise every opportunity cost in the known universe of what to do with your money, right? Start a business, invest in Bitcoin, mine Bitcoin. Just obviously there's anything, and everybody has their own personal risk profile. Everyone has, what they're looking to accomplish with their lives. And I really agree with your point with Bitcoin. I call Bitcoin and crypto a new type of technology. And if you want to geek out about it, they really are the first steps into what are known as essentially layer 8 and layer 9 of the internet, which are the finance and governance layers. And Bitcoin, I think, is the first step into those new layers, which are sort of the above the application layer that we sort of understand as the internet and the web itself. And this is all actually predicted quite some time ago by this badass woman named Evie Nemeth, who was sort of known as the mother of system administration. And she literally wrote the books on Linux and Unix administration. And she's so badass that she disappeared at sea while she was sailing around the world, I think, by herself. So
that is nuts.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy story. And she was really prescient, and she added sort of in her view layer 8 and 9 to the OSI model of the internet. The internet's not technically built on the OSI model; it's just built on TCP/IP, which also the U.S. Government and I think probably military and Department of Defense invented TCP/IP. There's your tax dollars at work. But the OSI model is more of a conceptual framework for understanding how the technology stack and the humans interact with each other and the function of those different sort of layers of the internet. So this was predicted a long time ago, and I call layer 8, and if you kind of go from the beginning, the first layers of the internet were very difficult to use, or really only academic people could use it. What we call the application layer is what like consumers and well, first business started using it. And then consumers and, personal use came to the application layer. And now that we're in layer 8 and 9, we're starting to move into those layers. I call those layers citizen technology. And the reason I use the word citizen is because it implies at least two things. One, the individual, which I think is very important. But two, it also implies society. So when you're running Bitcoin node or you're mining Bitcoin or another sort of decentralized protocol like Bitcoin, you're actually doing it. You could do it for personal reasons, like a personal reason to participate in Bitcoin is to send and receive Bitcoin between you and other people that you know. A business reason to participate in Bitcoin is because the asset could accumulate in value and it would be worth more to you. And then the citizen purpose of participating in Bitcoin is that you're literally building a part of the infrastructure of society that it needs to run. And instead of sort of offloading that to a third party, like the government, for example, where you are indirectly participating, you are directly creating the infrastructure for society to run when you're participating in Bitcoin. And that, to me, is what I call citizen tech.
That's an incredible explanation of just how important it is to participate in the Bitcoin network. It's really the first time in human history that the people of the world have a chance to be in control of the money instead of kings and tyrants and dictatorships. And I say that over and over again, but I can't stress it enough what an enormous opportunity this is. And the rest of the world outside the US has already greatly embraced it because they don't have systems that work. They need Bitcoin in order for their society to function the way America's does for the first time. So while we kind of listen to things here and go, yeah, it sounds kind of cool, but do I really need it? Well, guess what? If we don't get on board soon, there's a tsunami coming of the rest of the world, and we're going to be left behind if we don't.
Yeah, that could very much be the case. It's in the West, in the United States in particular, we have the sort of rails already for the finance stuff. But this is all, I think, somewhat inevitable. Big fan of Anton. I can never pronounce his name correctly.
Andreas Antonopoulos.
Yeah, one of the things that one of my favorite essays of his is essentially talking about how the old rails always participate in the new rails. So, he said, for example, when cars came along, people laughed at them and it was silly. Because roads weren't paved and there were no gas stations, so you drive your car along, and all the roads were made for horses, so they were bumpy, and your car goes flat, and you're stuck in the mud, and there's no gas station, so you're just an idiot you're a rich idiot for buying this thing. But later, as the infrastructure caught up, and you got paved or cobbled roads that cars could drive on, and you got gas stations. Interestingly enough, horses could still use these new rails, right? Horses can walk on paved roads, no problem. They probably prefer it. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe they're into natural movement. But the old rails can work on the new rails. And I think we'll find that to be the case. There's a great open source lawyer. I can't remember his name. And, Bitcoin, obviously, and a lot of these protocols are part of the arc of the history of open source. He called open source a practical revolution, because in the 70s and stuff, and particularly in the 80s, where open source really began to flourish, every Fortune 500 company laughed at the idea that they would ever use open source technology. Literally they laughed at it. And literally 100% of the Fortune 500 is running on open source technologies now, including Apple, including Microsoft. Some of their base kernels were built from, open source tech. So the reason open source is winning and has won in many ways is because it is a practical revolution. It is just practically better. It's not a violent revolution. It's not a populist revolution. It is a practical revolution. And so I actually think Bitcoin is a similar example. And when people sort of talk about, is this going to get nasty? Possibly. But I tend to think not. I tend to think crypto and Bitcoin are a practical revolution and don't require violence or populism to gain an increase in adoption. And so far, that's been true.
eToro is one of the largest trading platforms in the world, with over $1 trillion in trading volume on the platform every year. And they're some of our good friends, and they're a great sponsor. U.S. customers can trade the most popular crypto assets, and your fees are extremely transparent. So if you're not ready to trade yet, you could also practice building your portfolio with the eToro virtual trading feature. They give you $100,000 of virtual money, and you could start playing around with it and not have to risk any of your real money before you get comfortable with the markets. And best of all, you can connect with 12 million other eToro traders around the world, kind of like a social network for trading, to discuss charts and all things crypto. So go ahead, create an account today at eToro.com/crypto101. That helps us, that helps you, that helps them, and makes everything possible here if you guys use that link. So guys, start building your portfolio the smart way. eToro is crypto trading made easy. All right, back to the show. So with the last 10 or so minutes that we have, I want to do a deep dive on minor game theory, because while we have you, who better to talk about minor game theory than yourself?
Obviously.
So the first question is the age-old adage, does hash rate precede price? So that's question number one. And then number two is, what causes a miner to leave the network and join the network?
Yeah, I may have to ask you to repeat the second one. But on the first one, I think if you look at data, it does not, I think, I don't think there is a very strong correlation between the idea that hash rate precedes price. I think they have relation, and to some extent, there's just physical requirements that have to be met for hash rate versus price is far more liquid. So let me try and maybe explain through some examples. Let's go back to a bad example. Bitcoin price crashed 80% or whatever crazy amount last November, along with every other crypto.
But what we didn't see was an 80% drop in the hash rate. I think we saw something in the order of a 20 to 30% drop in the hash rate. Now that said, the current hash rate of Bitcoin, I think it's higher than it's ever been. And yet the price, which has, you know, returned quite an amount from its bottom, is still not up to where it was before. So the hash rate is highest than it's ever been before, but the price is not. Now, that's one thing that sort of happened. Another way to sort of think about it is price could, you know, go to a million overnight, and it could go to zero overnight. It has the sort of, you know, the speed and the liquidity of that is, you know, almost infinite, right? Hash power can come down very quickly, but it can't come up very quickly. Or at least it cannot come up as fast as it can go down. Because for it to go down, everyone just has to turn off their machines. So, like, you know, theoretically speaking, in 24 hours, everybody that's powering Bitcoin could turn off their machine. That's theoretically possible. But you could not bring 10 times more hash power onto the Bitcoin network overnight. There may not be enough ASICs. You have to get computers onto the system. So there are some, you know, this is not like a, there's some directions that things move quickly. There's some directions that things can move more slowly. All these things have relationships with each other, but I don't think they're super simple.
No, that's a really great explanation. Love it. Yeah, the last thing that miners are going to be selling off is their hardware, because it's the least liquid and it's the most difficult thing to sell off, right? But they're going to sell off their price. So it would make sense that hash rate drops off the network following the drop in Bitcoin price as they sell all their Bitcoin. They're like, okay, well, now we sold all our Bitcoin, our liquid assets. Now we got to start diving into our illiquid assets to start selling. And then you see the price fall. And that minor capitulation, there's a guy, Plan B, 100 trillion USD, whatever his name is on Twitter, who has this great chart of, price and hash rate. I'll share it with everybody here on CryptNation. But so the last question was, or the last question that I had mentioned was like, what generally causes, actually, no, we kind of already covered that. We covered that one. So let's do this. Do you believe that there's a future for proof of stake, and will CoinMine be supporting staking in the future?
I think there's a future for proof of stake. There's people running proof of stake networks successfully. Now, have they taken over the world? Not yet. Are they up and running? Yes. I think it's a different computation model, a different sort of incentive structure for proof of work. I think in some ways it's not as strong as proof of work, and potentially in some ways it may have some advantages. You know, I think to some extent there's a lot of misnomers of what these different protocols are. You know. Some protocols are trying to become a currency. Bitcoin is one of the best examples. Is the best example. I think Grin is a great example. Monero and Zcash, I think, are types of currencies, are trying to become types of currencies. Filecoin is not trying to become a type of currency. Definity is not trying to become a type of currency. Tezos is not trying to become a type of currency. Those are token-operated networks. They have a sort of currency layer in their protocol, which is kind of cool, and they are cryptographically protected, which is also cool. But they're not trying. You're never going to really be buying coffee with your Filecoin. So, just because I do think for a currency, proof of work is probably what you really want backing it.
I love that you name drop Definity in here. That just warms my soul.
Oh yeah, okay, I love those guys. And so I think if you're going to try to be a currency, proof of work is the way to go. If you're trying to do other types of token operated networks, decentralized networks, proof of stake may be fine.
I'm going to push back a little bit on that real quick, is because I think proof of work is great for new currencies that you're trying to issue, but you want to make sure that you're not using an algorithm like SHA-256, that it could very easily, your new currency could get 51% attacked with one big mining pool that comes over. Like, I know it happened with Ethereum Classic and a bunch of these currencies, I think Bitcoin or whatever, a bunch of these things where they have a algorithm that they're using to secure their network that already, that is like a very saturated market. So somebody could come in, switch over their power to this thing, attack it, and then it's fucked. So in that regard, maybe you'd have to admonish a new currency to have something like you never want to really roll your own crypto is something they also say. So it's kind of a quandary.
It's very much a catch 22, and there's new algorithms coming out all the time that try and prevent different things from gaining control. I know, like, for example, Komodo has their own proof of work, and then it does another verification on the Bitcoin network.
Oh yeah, merge mining.
Takes that result, and then it comes right back to Komodo, and it has to do it again. So it has this three-layer protection, and then Eternity has cuckoo cycles. And that basically does hashing with computer memory instead of CPUs or GPUs. So that's really interesting. There's all these different ways that people are coming out with to try and make mining fair and protect themselves against being 51% attacked. And it's really neat to see the different ideas people come up with.
I also, you know, think the 51% attack protection, I think in many ways comes from the game theoretic parts of it. It's 51% attacking Bitcoin right now is a great way to waste a lot of money and probably accomplish nothing.
Yeah, and then the people that do 51% attack it, it's like they 51% attack it, and then they get all this Bitcoin, and then people lose faith in the Bitcoin network and start selling off. So the assets that they just hacked essentially are now worth a lot less and trending towards worthless, right? Because people lose trust in the system. And you brought that upon yourself.
Yeah, and essentially it can all be known, and people can essentially move over to the correct chain, away from the chain that was changed. Right. It's all quite public, and you know, I don't think if Bitcoin was 51% attacked, people would just, you know, there would be consensus around moving to a different chain.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a lot of money. You have to spend millions, if not tens of millions of dollars to just sort of hopefully accomplish what you want. You probably devalue the thing that you were attacking. If anything, it would be if you wanted to take a shot at just destroying Bitcoin, you might want to throw all your money away. But sort of taking it over and taking all the monies is, I think, not 51% attack. Hacking is not likely to happen.
No, with all the hash rate being at an all-time high, like you said, it's very, very hard to scale up. There's just no way it could be possible. You know, it's at an all-time low for hash rate right now, and that's Bitcoin SV. So if you ever wanted to 51% attack Bitcoin SV, now would be the time to do it. Not an encouragement, just a stating data.
Yeah, so before we let you go, Farbood, we've got one final question. It's our favorite question to ask every single person that comes on Crypto 101. And the question is this. Of everybody in the cryptocurrency space, all the geniuses, all the crazies, all your friends, all your business partners, all your perhaps nemeses, who is one person that you really admire and why?
The answer would be probably Balaji Srinivasan. And I'm not going to say Satoshi. Because I don't know Satoshi,
and we can't tag Satoshi in a Twitter post either.
it would be Balaji. He knows a ton. I've learned a ton from him, and I think, you know, part of the reason is somewhat self-serving in the sense that I think you see the world similarly with regards to crypto and Bitcoin. So having someone who you have a similar worldview, but also knows so much, and you know, you can learn from and think through things together, it is really a special thing. So that's really been an awesome thing to be able to have.
Awesome. Well, that's a great shout out. We'll make sure he hears that. Farbood, thank you for taking the time and joining us. This has been a true pleasure, and all the crusaders here at Crypt Nation are gonna be very pleased to listen to this. And again, thank you for contributing the coin mine for the giveaway.
Sure.
This is going to be really exciting. We're going to announce the winner here on the Crypto 101 podcast.
Tell them one more time what they have to do to qualify now that the episode's over and they can go do it.
Absolutely. So yeah, so guys, real quick, you're going to go to crypto101podcast.com/giveaway. You're going to sign up, you know, shoot over your email. And then we're going to also make sure that you're following us on Twitter and joining our Facebook group. So if you have those three items checked, you are eligible. And the winner is going to be announced in exactly 1 week from the airing of this podcast. Farbood, thank you so much. You've been amazing. And hopefully we see you around soon.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for having me. I'd love that.
Take it easy. Crypt Nation, before you guys get out of here, don't forget to go to www.crypto2020summit.com and claim your free ticket to the biggest conference in crypto and blockchain history. It's going to be insane. You guys can watch it from the comfort of your own home in your little PJs, drinking your coffee. As you probably already know, the dates are January 29th to 31st. And we hope to see y'all there.